Chapter 15. The Avondrow. "This cavern is called Cascati," Elena explained to Catti Bree and the others as they came up over a rise and into a large chamber that was mostly covered by an ice shelf, but with much of the area open to the sky to allow in enough of the meager daylight to convey Cascati's size and majesty. The cavern was multi-tiered, full of blue-white ice formations, the most spectacular of which were the frozen waterfalls, some wide and with thin fans of ice, others narrow and matted to stone walls. It seemed to Catti Bree like a mountain cavern in the spring melt, water bursting from the stones but then flash frozen, locked in time as if the scene were an artist's rendering. It was colder in here than in the previous area, where the hot spring was more central and dominant, but not brutally so. It warmed comfortably as their hosts led them to the wider floor, where one area was not icy and cold at all, but had that stream running, banks lined with growth, flowers mostly. Wisps of fog lifted off the warm water, creating a blurriness that sharply contrasted with the crispness of the view from the higher vantage point. Peering past the icy formations, glistening pillars of frozen water, stalagmites of dark rock and blue ice, and fans of waterfalls, Catti Bree noted other lights, home fires, and even a structure or two. "Just a few families live here," Elena explained. And even as she finished speaking, some dogs began to bark. Echoes came at them from every direction, or perhaps it was more dogs answering. Catti Bree could not be sure. The entire chamber seemed to be alive with the calls, the music. The group moved around a procession of stalagmites near the chamber's left-hand wall. It opened abruptly to the right, and the four companions from the Southlands retreated to yet another strange sight and shocking surprise. Under the roof of a waterfall fan sat a small cottage of wood and stone. It had a front yard, fenced in with spaced wooden pickets. It was stone near the house, but then more soil, and then, nearest them, a long and narrow garden. "We should have brought pickle," Jarl Axel mumbled, and Catti Bree nearly giggled, thinking that yes, the druid dwarf would have loved this sight, particularly the way the garden had been set to perfectly catch reflections of the daylight off of various sheets of sparkling ice. She was about to say that to Jarl Axel when she looked up and even better understood why the rogue had thought of the unusual dwarf. Was standing before her on the small porch of the house was a family of dwarves, more unusual still, if they even were dwarves. At first she thought them all children, for they were diminutive, shorter than Regis even, and only one of them had a beard, albeit a small one, to go along with a twisting mustache. "Dwarves?" she asked. Gasped more than stated. "Inuga a Kalikurit," Elena explained.
"The what?"
Zaknafane asked.
"Or the curate, if you will, if that longer name ties your tongue."
"So, dwarves." Paler than a field of fresh snow, with pinched faces and curly white hair, the folk had the muscles and thick limbs of Delzoon dwarves. To be sure, but with their short frames they seemed as wide as they were tall. And despite all of that strangeness, the prominent features on each of the five standing before them were their huge eyes, so blue, bright blue, almost glowing from within.
"Yes.
Then why not call them that?"
"That is what they call themselves," said Elena.
"What do you call them?"
Zack asked.
"I call that one Kanak,"
the drow woman said with a laugh, "because that is his name."
"Eahail, Elena," said the dwarf with the beard and twirling mustache. "Found some more strays, haven't you? What no, eh?"
Catti Bree looked at Jarl Axel, who just shrugged his shoulders, as perplexed and stunned as she.
"They found us. New Avondrow?"
Kanak seemed truly surprised, as did the other dwarves on the porch.
"So it would seem, amico," Emelian answered.
"What no, eh?" Kanak said, shaking his head, long and curly white hair bouncing about his broad shoulders.
"Amico?"
Zack whispered under his breath.
"Abil," Jarl Axel answered, "the drow word for friend."
More of the diminutive folk.
The Inuga Kalikura dwarves appeared then, a group of about a dozen, and with them a pack of large, broad-chested, golden-furred dogs who barked and leaped, charging the group of intruders. Caddy Bree went into a defensive crouch, thinking they were about to be attacked, but the dogs had no such intent. Their barks became yips of playfulness, and with their tails wagging, they assaulted the drow hosts, not with bites and scratches, but by leaping up at them and licking. Caddy Bree watched Elena reach into a pouch and pull her hand out, carrying a pile of small treats, which she tossed into the air, sending the dogs into a scramble to catch, then snuff about happily on the ground for any they had missed.
"We need the chamber," Emelian said to Cunach. The dwarf nodded and sent one of the littler ones, one of his children it appeared, running into the small house to return a moment later holding a giant key ring that held only a single large key.
"That doesn't sound good," Entreri whispered to Jarl Axel, but Caddy Bree heard.
"Just trust," Jarl Axel whispered back.
"As if we have a choice," Zaknafane sourly added.
Another handful of dog treats went flying, the dogs bounding away after the falling kibble, and the Avendrow and Inuga Kalikurit exchanged some parting words as the dwarf child bounded up and handed the key ring to Emelian. The companions were led across the chamber to where several tunnel openings presented themselves in the high stone and ice wall. Also in the wall was a small carved structure made mostly of stone with a heavy wooden door. Emelian unlocked and opened it, revealing a darkened chamber within.
"You first," Elena said to Caddy Bree, and she took the woman by the arm and led her through the door.
Emelian left the door open, letting in enough light for Caddy Bree to see a small side room, and beside it, a large wardrobe of soft white clothing and thicker white robes with furred cuffs and collars. On a rack below sat pairs of simple soft shoes.
"Take one set of clothes and find some shoes," Elena instructed.
"Then remove all of your clothing, all of it, and all of your jewelry."
"Not this, I beg," Caddy Bree replied, tapping the unicorn scrimshaw she wore in a chain about her neck.
"And this," she added, revealing a circlet that was mostly hidden by her thick hair, a green-gray band of leather set with two gems that looked very much like the feline eyes that gave the magical item its name.
"The first is the symbol of my goddess, and the second grants me vision in the darkness."
Even as she finished, the door closed, leaving them in near complete blackness, reminding Caddy Bree that her cat's eye circlet really wasn't functioning anyway. She heard a scrape, and Elena lifted a lit candle.
"All of it," she repeated. "I am sorry, fellow priestess, but we know enough of the world beyond our homeland to understand that even the simplest and seemingly most innocuous of things can bring disaster if the magic within them is powerful enough. A small emblem can become a weapon, a circlet, an alchemist's grenade. I cannot inspect them for magic in the time of twilight autumn. Remove them, everything. Will they be returned?"
Elena didn't answer. Caddy Bree sighed and nodded. She stripped down to nothing, then found a suitable pair of pants and shirt from the wardrobe, pulling them on. The clothes were comfortable, at least, amazingly so, with a soft interior fur caressing her road-weary skin. She folded her own clothes and put all of her items together, her jewelry in a small pouch, then stepped aside. Elena handed her a robe, then gathered up the discarded items and put them in a bag, tying it tightly before leading her out of the room and back outside the chamber. A couple of the Avendrow had gathered near a large cart that had been brought out of a nearby tunnel by a group of dwarves and orcs.
"Orcs," Caddy Bree watched curiously, as one orc helped Emelian lift a large white slab.
"The ice from the bottom of the glacier," Elena explained to her. Caddy Bree looked to the priestess's sword with its beautifully decorated white blade.
"It has been pressed by the weight of the glacier walls for centuries, millennia," Elena explained. "It is very hard, as hard as metal."
"But brittle and able to melt."
"No. We know how to treat it to prevent such problems. I assure you, you do not want to feel the bite of an Avendrow weapon."
That last sentence rocked Caddy Bree back on her heels. She wasn't sure that Elena had meant it as a threat, but she also wasn't sure that Elena hadn't. And so it came as a pointed reminder of her predicament here, in her prisoner's garb, perhaps, and without weapons or magic to protect her. Her gaze reflexively went back to the orcs,
mostly the one with the white slab of ice, talking and laughing with Emelian. One by one, the outsiders were brought into the chamber and relieved of all their items, including their clothing. Soon the party was on its way once more, the four companions dressed identically in white clothes and robes and soft skin shoes. They felt comfortable, true, but most of all they felt vulnerable, and felt too marked for easy identification as if they were prisoners. From the time they had left Cascate, they walked through channels open to the sky, which was darker than they had seen it since arriving in the north, though more of a pre-dawn light than a true nighttime sky. Only occasionally did they have any ice over their heads, and only for very short distances. Beside them, the stream continued to flow with plants on either side, occasional insects buzzing or crawling about, and once, the walls falling away enough to present a wide meadow chamber inundated with white rabbits, dozens of them. Like the foxes, they showed no fear of the drow or the newcomers, and just went about their way, eating the thick clover that filled the chamber. Caddy Bree bent low near one large rabbit. She plucked a clover and held it out with an extended hand. She was testing the animal, which did indeed hop up and take the offering, but she was also testing their drow hosts here, watching Alina mostly out of the corner of her eye. The drow priestess smiled, and neither she nor the others hurried Caddy Bree along. By the time they came to a fork in the channel, the stream coming from straight ahead, another tunnel enclosed, moving off to the right, Caddy Bree had come to feel a bit better about this place and their hosts, so when the Avon Drow indicated the smaller tunnel, she followed without question and led the way among her companions. Except for Jarlaxle, who passed her just inside the tunnel, moving swiftly, eagerly. Oh yes, she thought. She would later have a word with that one. The tunnel wound and climbed. The floor was of ice, but not slippery, as it clearly had been roughed over. They went up carved stairs, then into a long, straight corridor, the other end of which seemed to open into a wide chamber. It wasn't until they came to the end of the tunnel that Caddy Bree and her friends began to understand just how wide. It wasn't until they came to the end of the tunnel that Caddy Bree and her friends had to remember how to breathe. "Behold Caladay, the burrow of Shelobel," Emelian announced, leading them out onto a wide ledge. It was a long while before Caddy Bree and the others were able to close their slack jaws. Below and before them lay a valley within the glacier. Caladay, the city of these northern people who call themselves Avon Drow, spread wide and sprawling, with gardens and houses and trees even. A wide stone ridge climbed almost to the top of the glacial ice, its side lined with houses of stone and wood, and carved avenues climbing like a giant snake back and forth. "It's bigger than Menzo Berenzon," she heard Zack whisper to Jarlaxle, and so it was, undeniably. Caddy Bree studied her drow companions. She saw the awe on Zack's face, his jaw still hanging open. He shook his head several times, as if not knowing how he should act. As expected, she found that this moment was different for Jarlaxle, less surprise, less awe, but more emotion. She saw the tears welling in his eyes, a sight she had never imagined, and one that filled her with sudden hope. And why not, she realized, looking again at the grand vista before her, the drow city of Caladay spreading wide. Several large buildings stood out from the normal structures, but none dominated. One, at least, and perhaps two or three others seemed to be chapels. Another large rectangular structure looked like something one might find along Waterdeep's docks. A warehouse, perhaps. But Caladay, or at least this section which they had called Shelobel, was not defined by the buildings, far from it. Wide fields lined by walls of piled stones covered much of the ground, including one right below the ledge, full of neat rows of leafy plants, among which many people moved carrying large baskets. A shift in the breeze brought the aroma from that field up to the ledge. "A vineyard," Entreri said, his surprise clear in his voice. "How many?" Jarlaxle asked Emelian. "How many?" Emelian echoed in response. "People," Jarlaxle clarified. "How many live here in Caladay? This is Shelobel, one of four boroughs that make up Caladay," the drow explained. and the largest because of the number of people here who are not Avendrow. Perhaps 15,000 of the Avendrow live within your sight from this ledge, but almost half that number of others as well. Like the Kurid you met in Kaskate, the Ulutians, humans, somewhat like your two companions, and the Arctos Orocs.
Orocs? Zachnephane said with some alarm.
Orcs, Catibree said, like the ones in Kaskate. Emelian nodded. Slaves? Catibree dared to ask, and the shock on the faces of those Avendrow who heard her was all the answer she needed. There are no slaves in Kaladay, Elena answered sharply. Never before, not now, never.
We are truly glad to hear that, Jarlaxle intervened.
Orcs and dwarves and... What did you call them? Catibree asked.
Ulutians, Emelian replied, his voice strained, as it seemed clear that Catibree's previous question had truly unnerved him.
Humans. Like you, but a bit different.
But no elves? Catibree asked.
Oh, yes. But not in Shelobel, said Emelian. There are just a few who happened upon us many years ago. They call themselves Eladrin.
High elves.
Yes, they have found great joy here and have made their own families.
Families of Eladrin? Catibree pressed, suddenly very interested.
One, I think, Emelian answered.
Yes, one couple, Elena added. They have two children.
Two of the other three who stayed with us have sired or birthed children, too, but they are only half Eladrin, of course.
Catibree bit her lower lip.
15,000 Avendrow here? We're in the four boroughs combined, Jarlaxle asked.
Here in Shelobel. Almost twice that number in the other three boroughs.
Come, welcome to my home.
40,000 drow, Jarlaxle whispered to Zack.
Twice Menzo Berenzon, the weapon master answered.
To the left of them was a long stairway carved in the stone, but Emelian didn't go that way. He went right to the lip of the wide ledge where he sat down, looked back and smiled, and disappeared over the edge. When the companions went up to that spot, they found an icy slide with high walls running down the side of the glacier. Emelian was already far below, lying back and speeding along. He went left suddenly onto a high bank, then turned back fast to the right, disappearing feet first into the glacier.
Catibree gasped, and she was not the only one.
It is fun, she heard Elena say behind her. Exciting, you will see.
The last time she'd gone down an ice slide, an avalanche had been chasing her, not exactly what she considered fun.
Yet when Catibree glanced back at her, Elena nodded for the woman to go with a gentle smile. She had no magic, she had no weapons, she didn't even have her proper clothing, and she found herself in a strange land at the mercy of her hosts or captors or whatever these Avendrow were, completely at their mercy. So Catibree shrugged, sat down, and shoved off.
Lie back, she heard Elena call behind her as she slid faster. She did so, and her speed increased immediately. She tried to keep steady, feet out before her, but every slight turn sent her up on one bank or the other.
She screamed when she went out to the left suddenly, and the fright became childlike glee when she abruptly went into the tunnel, speeding along in what soon became near complete darkness. More sudden turns, breath-stealing drops, even what she thought might be a complete loop, kept her screaming, half in terror, half in joy, before the tunnel finally straightened out in a long run, only slightly descending. She came out of the glacier wall just to the right of the vineyard she had seen from up above, shooting fast deeper into the town. The slide ascended then, gradually slowing her, so that when she came to the end of the ride, she was on a raised platform nearly 100 long strides out from the wall. Emelian stood above her, holding down a hand for her to take.
Better than 200 stairs, he asked.
Catibree brushed down her robes, which had climbed halfway up her belly, taking her shirt with them. She sat up and took the offered hand.
Can I do it again? She asked, grinning from ear to ear.
Emelian laughed. I have done it 1,000 times, and it still steals my breath, he told her. I often forget things when we leave on patrol and have to come back to Shelobel. But don't tell Elena that I do it on purpose.
Zachnephane came in next, then the other companions in quick succession, with Elena coming last.
The other three Caladaeans remained on the high ledge and waved their goodbyes. "Alina will take you to a place where you may eat and rest," Emelian explained. "I will arrive later to take you to the Inquisitors."
"Inquisitors?" Jarlaxle echoed.
"They will hear your story," Emelian explained. "They will pass judgment." "It would be easier if it were not the Twilight Autumn," Alina added. "Then they could use magic, of course, to arrive at their answers. But fear not, just tell them the truth of your journey and your arrival and your intent. You are not among enemies unless you make it so," Emelian explained. He singled out Jarlaxle and Zacnaphane. "You two in particular will draw great curiosity. You are not of the Avon Drow, yet you are obviously Drow. This is most remarkable." "The Avon Drow," Jarlaxle echoed, simply because he liked the sound of it.
"Avon Susan Inde Drow," Emelian explained.
"The Starlight Drow, the Avon Drow. Come," Alina bade them, despite the numerous questions hovering on their lips, and she led them across the city, past a sea of curious eyes, Avon Drow curate and Octos Auroch alike, and one group of a dozen or so that seemed to be humans, or perhaps halflings, or some combination thereof. They were short, the tallest still several inches shorter than Caddy Bree, with dark hair and eyes, bronzed skin, flat round faces, and curious smiles showing broad white teeth.
"You Luthians?" Caddy Bree whispered to Alina.
"Yes." "The Gila family. Their people came from a nearby village in the mountains." That perked up Caddy Bree's ears. "Family, yes," she realized when she looked back at the group as they passed and realized that she was staring at three, perhaps even four generations.
"Evil befell their home and the glacier encroached upon it," Alina explained as they continued their walk.
"Many were killed, but the Gilas and some others escaped. The two oldest there, Jissi and Anji, were just children when they came to us for shelter. They became our most accomplished handlers."
"Handlers?"
"Of the Tef, the sled dogs you saw back in Cascati."
"Sled dogs?"
"Mugtef," Alina told her. "The golden coats. The Hetef are white. The Octef black-coated. And of course, there are combinations of all, as one can expect from dogs."
"As one can expect from Eladrin and Avon Drow?" Jarlaxle slyly asked, and Alina laughed.
Caddy Bree just shook her head. It was all too much. Too much information, too much difference. She felt as if she were in a delusion, in some strange land she could never have imagined, and surrounded by people familiar and yet not, like friends one might meet only in a dream. But thus far, at least, it was just a dream and not a nightmare. Her eyes went to Alina's sword, and her thoughts went to Alina's warning.
"I trust you are comfortable," the Inquisitor said to Caddy Bree.
She sat in a straight-backed wooden chair, a plain table before her set with a glass of cold water. A trio of Avon Drow, who had identified themselves only as Inquisitors, sat in the shadows on the other side of the room, on a raised dais and in taller chairs, so as to tower above her in an obvious attempt at intimidation. The only light in that area came from a candelabrum on the floor, uplighting the Inquisitors, which made them even more imposing. They hadn't threatened her with their words, but their posture and positioning were hardly neutral. "You understand that we must ensure most of all the safety of our home," the woman on the left end explained.
"We are no threat to you."
"You came here, you found us," said the man in the middle. "That alone is a threat."
"An accident. A fortunate one for us and no threat," said Caddy Bree.
"So you say," declared the first.
"Ask your questions," Caddy Bree invited them.
"You are a priestess, we are told," the woman went on. "And so you know that there are ways in which we could magically determine the veracity of your claims, and perhaps even search that which is in your heart unsaid. But you also know that we are in the time of Twilight Autumn, the fading, and in this time magic is unpredictable and greatly weakened if accessible at all. Thus our task is doubly difficult. For without those three armors, we are reduced to evaluating the impression that you and your companions make upon us, and we must trust in that, and only that, for another several days.
So we will be imprisoned for that time," Caddy Bree reasoned.
"Hopefully not," said the woman.
we do not wish to keep you in a dungeon.
But will, if needed, the stern man in the middle said. We would like you to enjoy Shelobel, perhaps all of Caladay, the woman pressed past him, and Catibri knew the technique, where one tried to be soft and friendly, the other playing the threat. It is ironic, but in this time of the great reduction of our magic, Caladay itself approaches its most magical day, Quisticanze. Magic swims in the dark sky, waves of beauty and song. I hope that you will partake in the celebration, but to do so, you need to tell us how and why you came here, to this land that is rarely visited by those who live in the Southlands.
Catibri complied. She told them of the sword and the hunt for Dumweel, even why she had been asked to come along as another who had once, long ago, fallen under the domination of Kazidea. She offered a warning with her tale to her captors regarding handling that malevolent blade, for if its magic returned and it caught a wielder unaware, that person would likely be overtaken and perhaps driven to dangerous deeds. A chuckle from the man in the center stopped her there.
Many years ago? He asked skeptically. We are to believe that?
We know humans. You expect us to believe that many years ago you wielded such a weapon, though you were but a child?
Are you nobility, then, in this land you left behind?
No, Catibri replied with a nervous chuckle. No, although... Yes, I am now considered such by some, since my father is a dwarven king.
She laughed helplessly. How could she begin to explain her life and all the twists and turns and adventures? How could she explain her death, if the time in Iruladun even was death, or her return as a chosen of Mialiki, sent to do battle with the woman who had inadvertently become the chosen of Loth?
How could she begin to explain it all? I am much older than I appear. But thank you for the compliment, she answered.
Before the man could reply, she went on with her story of the magical portal that had put the four of them in this place they did not know, of their journey across the Northland before they happened upon this glacial rift. Pointedly, she did not tell them of the cave and the fight with the giant and the frog-like monster, as the four companions had agreed back in the original glacial chamber. But she did tell them of the abandoned town and the reaction of the glacier itself when they had torn a small rift to the plane of fire with Zack's whip and Catibri had tried to reach into that plane with her ring. That brought some nods, for all of those possessions, although mostly inert at this time, it seemed, were in the hands of the Aven Drow. Still, sages among these Drow should have been able to identify, or at least guess, the general powers of the distinctive items.
Dumweel Armgo is dead, the drow in the middle told her. No, she isn't, Catibri replied. Or at least if she is, it happened only recently, within the past day or two.
Even in the shadow, she could see the man shaking his head.
Forget her, he said. She fell victim to the uninhabited, and so Dumweel as you knew her is forever dead.
Catibri started to ask, but the woman cut her off.
Now that you know the futility of your search, perhaps you would like to leave. But you cannot, not now. You would die in the cold wind without your magic, of course.
Catibri shrugged. What was to be said?
They led her out of the room then, bringing her through the door on the right-hand wall, opposite from the door through which she had entered, and where her friends waited, each in their own small cell in a large room of many such tiny chambers, a place that reminded her of the meditation hallways of the Monastery of the Yellow Rose. Elena and Emelian were waiting for her beyond that door.
A remarkable story, the lead inquisitor told his two companions when the door closed once more. One of many, I suspect, that we might hear from this human. Both he and the woman who had questioned Catibri looked to the end of the table at the third of the group, a strong woman sitting with perfect posture, a reflection of the discipline she carried through her every day. Her white clothing was pressed and sharp, her blue hair cut neatly. She held a small coffer, mostly glass, a reliquary showing the skull of a white fox inside.
Mialiki, the other woman said. She is another name for your own god, yes, Galathe?
A sister goddess, at least, the drow paladin answered.
What did you sense? Asked the drow man. And can you trust it in this time of twilight autumn?
I sense no evil in her, Galathe replied. not in intent or in memory. I believe I would trust the safety of Caladay on that feeling, even in this time, and particularly since the lightness and warmth of this one resonated so strongly. Let us bring the others through to see if they are of similar weal. Jarlaxle was the last of the group to sit before the Inquisitors, and he wasn't the least bit intimidated. He worried that perhaps he was letting his elation at simply seeing Caladay and learning of this place and these people put him off his guard, but it was really of minor concern to him. If the Avendrau had wanted him and his friends dead, they'd already be dead. He told the same story to the panel of three that Catti Bree, Entreri, and Zacnaphane had related. He, too, resisted telling them about the fight in the cave, although he wasn't sure that they should bother to keep that secret, and expected that it wouldn't hold for much longer anyway. Why had the green slot impersonated a drow? Was it because it had seen Zack in the deeper chamber battling a frost giant, or because it knew of these drow? Both likely, but that hinted to Jarlaxle that the slot and the frost giants, that clan at least, were not in league with the folk of Caladay. "You are the leader of this expedition?" asked the man, centering the three on the dais. "I organized it, yes." "But you don't even know where you are?" asked the woman to his right. "You ask us to believe this?" "Have the others told you of Archmage Gromph?" Jarlaxle answered with a question of his own. "The one who created the portal," the woman confirmed. "A great wizard, one of the most powerful in the South, and perhaps the most powerful of all in the Underdark when he lived there, serving as the Archmage of Menzo Baranzon, the city of your relatives." "The city of spiders," so said your fellow drow companion. "Yes, I will tell you more of it." "You presume our interest," said the man in the center, "and our ignorance." "Our concern is Caladay, and Caladay alone," the woman who had been speaking added. "You do not give us confidence in our ability to trust you by speaking to us of great wizards and underdark cities. We know well that some of our kin traveled there in the great separation of the peoples." "They are very unlike you," Jarlaxle remarked. "Are you?" The drow shrugged. "We did not come here just to find Dumuil and to try to break the demonic influence within a sword," he admitted, and that raised the eyebrows of the two. Though the woman on the other end of the stage remained wholly impassive, outwardly at least. "My friends likely believed so, but I had other intent." "Do you know of Silvery Moon?" he asked. "Yes," came a surprising answer. "I was there recently, following a rumor of an elf, another Eladrin, who once found a most unusual civilization in the frozen Northland, beyond the reach of the known kingdoms of Faerun." They didn't react. "A drow civilization," Jarlaxle added. "Or Avendrow, perhaps." Still no reaction. "Or maybe it was just a dream. That is what those around this very ancient Eladrin believed, or that his old mind had become incapable of distinguishing fantasy from truth. Fear not, for he is not taken seriously." "Yet you are here," the woman answered. "Because above all, I wanted his dream to be true. Because I needed it to be true, and also because the hunt for Dumuil is true and good and holds great importance for a coming conflict among my people. Thus I had another reason to come here and to convince my companions to follow. That reason is gone now, as is Dumuil." "So you said. Would you have us be on our way? You have no magical protection. You would die. Lend us your clothes." "No. You cannot leave before the fall of night and the end of twilight autumn," said the man. "When magic returns, when our magic will protect us." "Of course. And when your magic will protect you," Jarlaxle understood. He thought of the old elf in Silvery Moon, who hadn't told his tale of drow in the north for many years, and now whispered it as gibberish more than reality, like the waking dreams of one caught more in memory and fantasy than in the world as it was around him. Perhaps that old elf was confused, his mind diminished. Perhaps his tale held no truth at all, and the presence of the Avendrow here was mere coincidence. Or perhaps the magic that had erased his memories of Caladay for all these decades, centuries even,
had worn away enough for that old elf to now dream of a place he once knew. "We have no desire to meet the people of the South," the woman inquisitor explained to him, "nor anyone of the Underdark, surely. Yet your people came out to find us. You could have let us die. It was by chance. And of course, we could not leave you to die, like the Ulutians, who lost their town to the glacier, or the Inugaa Kalikurit wanderers, who were found out on the ice, or the ones you call orcs, who roam the region. We have made their lives better, as they have made our lives better. They have become a part of Kaladay, a part we treasure. They fight in Kalchi, tend our fields with us, create artwork, share their songs and dances. That could be your future, too, if your tales are true and your heart is good. Perhaps a future you might consider. For all the complexities and thrills of his life in the South, such a notion was not one Jarl Axel found he could easily dismiss. But neither did he miss the first mentioned contribution. "Kalchi," he asked. "Is this an enemy?" He thought of the Slod and the Frost Giants, hoping to find an opening here to further solidify any alliance he might forge. "Kaz Kalchi," the man answered. "The Battle of Twilight Autumn. Take heart, my friend, for you have come to us in a time of feast and play." "And battle?" The two inquisitors who had been questioning him looked at each other and grinned. Then they looked to the third, who nodded. "Go to your friends, Jarl Axel," the man told him. "You are free to wander the burrow, indeed, the whole of the city. Emelian and Elena will guide you if you choose, or you can make your own way. You will find food and drink plentiful." "And dance and song," the woman added. "Add to that if you can, or tell great tales of old, and you will find many smiles of gratitude." When they quieted, Jarl Axel rose and bowed, starting for the other door. "One more thing," the woman called after him. "On my advice, do not miss the persimmons."
"Persimmons?"
"A small orange, I know what it is," Jarl Axel interrupted, too surprised to maintain his polite decorum. "Fruit, tangy."
"Ah, but you have not tasted it paired with aged Kurit muskox cheese and chased down with holico, the Shelebeli ice wine."
She pursed her lips, pressed her fingers against them and smacked her lips, extending her hand wide as she threw it forward toward a very confused Jarl Axel. He didn't know the details, of course, or what a muskox might be, or holico for that matter, but that wasn't the real source of his confusion. No, it was the pride. The welcoming pride this inquisitor, whose name he did not know, had just relayed to him.
"Fine advice, Jarl Axel," the man agreed. "That delicacy alone may make you think your journey to this difficult land worth the trouble."
Shaking his head, trying not to chuckle, Jarl Axel went through the door and soon rejoined his friends.